What's up, everybody? We're here for Mudball Monday.
I get it, but it didn't quite work. And so for that reason, the Biarritz is going to be slightly on the overrated side for me.
Yeah, like that's why the leave-in to me is so good, is because it's just like such simple strategy that if you don't really understand the hole, you're kind of like, what's the deal here? Like, I'm just going to see ball, hit ball. But you should not be doing see ball, hit ball when it comes to the leave-in.
Yeah, dude, queso's bullshit. And I'm here for all the haters.
Imagine an awesome cape where rather than bunkers, it was just like a slightly popped up green and it's just short grass as your penalty. Like,
I'd probably go croissant, but okay. but by a hair.
Good day, everybody. Thank you for joining us once again at the Tie Podcast. It is Mudball Monday, episode 108, I believe. I think I'm correct on that one. Walker Simas, thank you for joining me as always. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here. It's hoodie gang season. We both rocking the black hoodies. It is officially fall golf season. Coffee nearby, water nearby, electrolytes nearby. Not going to get too deep in the weeds. We've got self coming for you guys today. And we're talking templates, so it's going to be good. Henry, give us the brief intro on what we're going to be talking about today, and then I'll dive into self.
Well, I do. I want to quickly hit on the hoodie weather. I am pissed with a capital P. We're getting the classic Austin, Texas, just like 180 degree shift in the weather. It's currently probably 78, 79 out there, and the high tomorrow is 49. Tomorrow morning, it's going to be like 36. It's literally about to drop like 45 degrees in a matter of 12 hours, which just pisses me off. I got people out here saying I can't wait for the fall weather. I like it cold. And I'm just like slinging middle fingers left and right. Give me back to the 100 degree days. I absolutely love it. So we'll leave that there. When it comes to templates, we're going to be talking templates today. A typical over, under, properly rated. We each have chosen three different templates, one to fit within each category. And we'll get a little bit spicy here, throw some overrateds, but then we'll do some underrateds, we'll do some properly rateds. And it's always fun to talk about the templates. Provides for some good discourse and a little back and forth between the fellas. So before we do that, we're getting into self, our second Mudball Monday acronym, sleeping, eating, learning, and fitness. Walker, lead us off. What do you got?
Dick it away. Let's see. Sleeping. I've got this like increasing sleep debt that I'm trying to knock down. I got a good nap in yesterday, which I don't normally do and frankly don't like doing all that much. Like, I find it pretty tough to get into bed for an hour and then like get up and get back after it. So I'm just trying to figure out how to knock that sleep debt down. As for like, you know, normal business hours, getting sleeping in, it's been quite good. Like, you've had a lot of travel this summer. And I've gotten to see you like just try to make it work when, you know, you're switching time zones or trying to make this and that work. You've still got priorities that you got to get done. And so I've been trying to balance some of that. Like, a little bit of the travel has been not new to me, but new regarding what I've been doing the last couple of years. So, yeah, it's just been a game of like, hey, can you sneak in an extra 20 minutes? Or I've had a couple of nights here where it's like, hey, you know, you're not exactly tired yet, but just go ahead and get in bed and you'll be thankful for it the next morning. That's been a little bit of the game. And then I'll key in a little bit later on the fitness section to kind of a little something to accompany that. Eating has been just so unsexy, but so functional the last like 2 to 3 weeks. I've been eating just like more protein really than I ever have. Just like really trying to get the numbers up so that I can, so that, you know, the work pays off, frankly. I find it hard when I'm moving a lot to just get the extra, you know, 500 calories in that are honestly not that hard as long as you're diligent about it. But that's been a focus of late, is same thing with sleeping. Like, how can you wring out the towel? How can you get those last 500 calories in? Because I'm pretty good with the other stuff. Like, always seem to prioritize quality. So it's just, how can you get those extra calories in? That's been the gamer. Smoothies have been big. I mean, I'm not going to hit y'all over the head with like my regular shit, because it's just been, honestly, you know, 10% more of everything that I love eating. So that's eating. Learning, along really the same token, is just squeezing every day of what it's worth. Like, you wake up with 70%, great. Like, figure out a way to give it 71. And then, as we know, Henry and I have been talking about this a lot. You know, when you're moving throughout life, every now and then you wake up and you say, oh boy, I'm ready. Like, I feel 100%. My mentals are good. My physicals are good. You know, we're syncing up with fall now. So we've got some beautiful days to work with. And when everything lines up like that, you are doing yourself a disservice for not taking advantage of it. And so keying into my fitness really has just been, what can you do to just be exhausted and wrung out by the end of the day? Following that up with, hey, how can I try to get in bed 20 minutes earlier or something like that? And going back on something that I've shared, it was a Chris Paul deal from a couple of months ago. It was just like stacking days. Like, if you can figure out how to put two or three of those things together day over day over day, and do that a couple weeks in a row, you're going to really like where you're at, and you're going to wake up feeling 100% more often than you did before. So really, that's like, you guys can kind of tell where my head's at. It's just been, you know, getting ready for this marathon and just trying to stay on the P's and Q's. And I sound like Brooks Koepka after a live event. Like, it's all about the process, man. But it is. It really is. So that's my sell for this week. Kicking it back to Shimp. What you got for us?
You know, why did O&R not get any love? People talk about the P's and Q's, like O coming before P, R after Q. Like, what's wrong with the O&R?
I think first of all, they combine to be OR, which, you know, nobody likes a second option, you know? So
I'm not a big Oregon fan, you know, in terms of the OR being Oregon.
What about the R, though? I'm trying to figure out where the R fits in. Ring the towel, you know, that's a good thing. Why are we being so hard on R? Yeah, I'll have to think about that one.
R, color, red, varietals. That's where my mind is going, but I'll spare people varietals talk for the time being. Okay. Self, sleeping. You know, not a massive report here, like somewhat similar to you. My sleep is usually pretty good. It's been pretty good. There are just too many days. So my big thing, I think you're probably slightly different here. Like, my body, it don't sleep past 5:30 or so. Like, it's kind of 5 to 5:30 is when I wake up. I've been finding this really interesting pattern. Anytime I'm kind of in my own bed for the majority of the time, like, let's say, you know, 90%+ of nights over a 2 to 3 week period, I consistently wake up 30 minutes before whenever my alarm is set to go off that day. Which I actually really like, because then what I do, I sleep at like 65 degrees. I like to have it pretty cold. If I wake up at say 4:30 and I'm meant to get out of bed at 5, I'll turn my temperature up to like 75. So then by the time I'm actually getting out of bed, my apartment's already warm. It's really nice, and it sleeps a little bit on the electricity bill. So I don't hate that. But yeah, like, my biggest thing when it comes to sleep is just, if I go to bed at 11:30, I might sleep till 5:45. If I go to bed at 8:30, I'll probably sleep till 5. So it's just important for me to get in bed early enough, because yeah, if I did it for 6 days in a row and I'm going to bed at midnight and waking up at 5:30, like, at some point it would probably get pushed back. But if I neglect getting in bed early enough, like, I just sleep for 5.5 hours, and you can't really do that too many days in a row. You can try, but all of a sudden it starts to kind of crash and burn. At least for guys like us. I'm, you know, if we have any like truckers listening to this, or people kind of in the service industry, they're probably just laughing their heads off. Like, yeah, man, I work 15 hours a day at a manual labor job, and drink 6 coffees and sleep 4 hours, and you guys are just soft. But we are soft, so that is what it is. Rolling into my eating, you know, I two comments here. Like, I'm rolling on with the taco chat. Like, it has been the dish of the fall, the tacos, just so many tacos going down. And I do not discriminate against a single taco varietal. I mean, I'll eat all of them. Pork tacos, beef tacos, fish tacos, chicken tacos, breakfast tacos, lunch tacos, dinner tacos, Tex-Mex tacos, Mexican tacos, like,
dessert
give
tacos.
It all to me. dessert tacos. But the one thing that doesn't belong on a taco, I think we're going to be on the same page here, but I'm curious to hear your reaction. Don't give me queso on a taco. Frankly, I think queso is egregiously overrated just in a general sense, but in particular, a taco does not need queso. Cheese is different than queso. I'm not talking about Spanish here. I'm talking about the English, you know, queso dish. That does not belong on a taco. Yay, nay?
Yeah, dude, queso is bullshit. And I'm here for all the haters. We were having this conversation the other day about milkshakes and how I've had a couple of milkshakes this year.
Fitch.
Well, they're super fitch, but in the wrong way. Like, there's got to be some xanthan gum situation or something terrible. And queso is the same way, where, like, sometimes I'll have queso. Not going to call out, you know, somebody on the shit list. Now, I don't want to give them any more publicity than they deserve. But, yeah, I just, if I have queso, there's a line between, oh, dude, that, I don't need much of that, but I want that. And I just don't want to touch that at all. I don't want to be anywhere near that. And I find that, you know, those who are trying to cut corners on the queso find themselves in the vast majority, which is, hey, man, I just don't really want that in my bowl, in my taco, on its own, with chips, whatever. I don't want that. So, yeah, I'm anti-queso. Now, you start getting a little queso fresco action, a little bit of really any kind of cheese I'm down for.
Yeah, but it just can't be queso.
It just can't be queso.
You know what queso reminds me of? It's like it's a family of three, and you're a family with three kids, and, like, you know, the first one, complete stud, like quarterback at Harvard, shit like that, you know. Second one comes up, a little bit different vibe. Like, he's a swimmer, but, you know, gets a scholarship to Princeton, like, to another stud. And then queso comes along, the third one. And he's like, no, like, I'm dropping out of high school. I'm not doing this. And likening this to dips, God, this is stupid. Like, to me, you got hummus. That's your first kid. You got guac. That's number two. And then queso's the third one. Just the complete and utter black sheep of the family when it comes to dips. Like, queso is for little boys. If queso is your dip of choice, if you're ranking queso ahead of guacamole and hummus, among many other dips that we could talk about, but those are some of my top few there. You're playing the game, plain and simply wrong. Queso chat.
Let's set the tone. Let's continue this dip conversation into next week's Mudball Monday. We're gonna be talking DOCs. Yeah, DOCs. That's what we're getting into. So keep you posted.
DOC is dips of choice for those that sit on the same page here. Yeah.
Yes.
We hadn't talked about that before, but I knew where you're headed. Okay. Last thing on tacos. I'm not a smart man. I am an observant man. Last two, like, banging workouts that I've had, like, I'm talking, you know how it is when, like, you eat the right things and it's the right period of time in between. Of course, there's some caffeine from our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Go hammer it. Use code thetie at goodwalkcoffee.com if you want some high quality beans for a little caffeination. But when you get all of those things just right, and then you get 80% of the way through the workout when you're supposed to be like, yeah, I'm pretty darn beat right now, and I just got to hammer out that last 20%. And you're like, no, like, let's double this shit. Like, let's take it from the top and do it again. Both of those two workouts over the last month induced by breakfast tacos. Again, I'm not smart. I'm just observant. Learning. Other than learning about what to eat pre-workout, I've had this character development thing going through my mind. Like, going through your day and viewing yourself as a different character in different aspects of your life. And I think this just dips back into being present for each thing you're doing. Something that I picked up, I mean, you know, this is no hot take, but something that Sean Foley talked about a lot in the episode that we did recently. Interesting conversation there. If anyone hasn't listened to that was our most recent interview with Sean Foley, of course, Coach Tiger and many other PGA Tour players, but he talked about presence. And so, to me, like, this idea of showing up to different parts of your life as a different sort of character is an interesting concept. It's like, okay, when I show up to work, like, I'm a double worker, whatever my job is, you know, I'm there to be efficient, be intelligent, get the job done, do that, focus fully on that. Okay. If I go play golf, like, I'm a golfer for 2 hours, you know, and I don't need to blend the two. I don't need to pull the phone out and be doing emails on the third hole. Like, unless you are going to change course in something that you're doing yourself a disservice in each facet of your life to try to blend the two. You know, if you're okay, if you get an email on the third hole and you're going to leave and go facilitate that, then great. But if you're a golfer, be a golfer. If you're working, work. Don't sit there on Instagram and things like that. So showing up to each part of my life is a different sort of character and telling myself, this is what I am for the next however many hours, and I'm going to play into that in its fullest, has been something that's been adding value for me. So character development. Moving into fitness, one of the many characters that I take on a daily basis. The road to 200 is going well-ish. Had been seeing some great numbers recently. I think this week, I saw a little 192. I saw a little 193. Awfully disappointed this morning in 187. That came out of fucking nowhere.
It was just a ginormous coffee drop. That's all that was.
Yeah. I'm from our friends at Good Walk, one of the many things we love. So what it really was is, I don't know why, and this is stupid, because I'm trying to make this final push here. If I can just get to Thanksgiving at like 194.5, like it's over, it's easy. Our beloved pecan pie. God bless. If you haven't heard that Mudball Monday, dip back deep in the archives for that conversation about a little FMK on Thanksgiving pies. That'll get me over the line. But so anyway, the running shoes have been whispering to me. They've been like, come on, we're bored. Like, get us out there. And so the last few days I've been putting some miles in, which is stupid. I'm trying to gain weight out here, but I want to. But I live by the motto, burn hot, eat a lot. So I've been burning really hot and I've been eating a really, really lot. So that just is what it is. And that's going to continue for a long time here. We're talking about fitness. Like the Thai guys, we'll release these maybe in the end of your pod. But, you know, Simus has a marathon coming up. We've put together some running goals as well for next year. But that does not mean turning into, you know, this is not born to run sort of stuff. Like you're not going to catch me weighing 172 looking like a piece of alfalfa. You know, it's weights and miles and calories, baby. That's going to be basically the next year and many years after that. So that's the fitness game. That's self. Let's move on. Let's talk templates. I'll kick it to you, Walker, to lead us off with your overrated template, starting with the smoke.
Yeah, dude.
We'll see if there's fire.
I want nothing but discourse here, and I fear and am excited for what's to come. My overrated template today is going to be the Biritz, and the one and direct only angle that I'm taking here is the merge of conditions and intent of the architect. And when I was thinking about, okay, well, how are we going to deliver these templates in such a way that's like, hey, I think this is overrated or underrated or properly rated, I was like, okay, the things that are at least important to me is we need a little bit of historical context, and we also need to know kind of what this design template is asking from the player. And then thirdly, something I grapple with often with holes that I play is like, okay, I know how I play it, but how does you know, the full slew of golfers with all their different approaches and skill levels tackle this sort of hole? And so that's kind of how I'm going to break down all three of my categories today. And I'm kind of hoping that you have a different way to approach this so we can kind of kick it back and forth. So the Biritz, as most of you know, being a fairly common template hole, is kind of like a ruffled napkin. Imagine a napkin placed between two tables that are, you know, an inch apart from each other. It's a green complex that is geometric in shape, either slightly rounded or just straight off squared, usually seen on longer par threes, not always, but usually seen on longer par threes with a ginormous dip in the middle of the green. Now, there are kind of two types of Biritz holes in my eyes. There's the type of Biritz hole where the green space occupies the front section, the dip, and the back. And
a lot
then
of dip
there,
talk today.
A lot of dip talk today. You kind of read my mind there. That's fine. And it'll continue into next week. And then there's the kind where that front section is fairway cut and the dip occupies not even the green. It occupies kind of the dip before you see the green and then The grain complex is kind of that entire back shelf. In 1888, Willie Dunn Jr., he designed what was the first Biarritz green, and it was dubbed the Chasm, which is a badass name. And then C.B. McDonald took it up, basically, and everyone
Piping
hated
Rock was
it.
The first one.
I don't.
In the U.S.,
I think,
that is.
Well, yes, but the first one I believe was at the club was actually named after the template. It was
so, and this is
Biarritz
the whole
golf club,
right? This is the whole problem with Biarritz. This is in all seriousness here. If I'm not mistaken, it's the only template that doesn't come from the UK, and it's Biarritz, France. Like it is, it's the French template. Like,
and
we've talked about,
you know,
the
how,
French at the time before. Like,
damn right.
Come on. Of course it's going to be overrated if it's the French template. Like, fucking A.
Yeah, and I'm surprised. Obviously, we see one at Mid-Ocean Club, but I'm surprised that we don't see more Biarritzes in kind of coastal environments. Now, this is kind of another thing that we'll get into is conditions. Like, if we're talking thatch being, you know, kind of the
grass that accumulates underneath the surface you can see over years.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Yes, and it reduces, you think about, okay, how do I want my turf to play? Pretty much as close to a Walmart parking lot as possible. And it does the opposite of that. It's the mad killer to the bounce. And so, you know, in thatchy environments, aka you know, coastal environments, you're just not going to get that bounce. And a Biarritz kind of requires it. It is a prerequisite. I think Biarritz is kind of the most audacious design in that it requires some sort of thump on that turf for things to work out. And so what does it test? Like, what does the Biarritz actually test? Obviously, you're going to be hitting a longer iron, a wood, or potentially even a driver into this sort of hole. It obviously tests your line, right? So you're looking at a dead straight driving range type shot. But once you get offline, you're now dealing with a green that is giving you really funky angles, right? Like, you've got some sort of false front that you're now approaching from the side, whether you're in a bunker, short, long, whatever. The angles get much, much weirder as you deviate from kind of the center of the green. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, I think the only thing that saves a Biarritz, frankly, is the front pin. We can get into that later. But where it really gets me is you've got to hit this shot that is exactly what you intend as far as trajectory and spin, right? Like, let's say, for example, that you want to chase one to that backhoe location. Okay, well, you're going to have to plan to land that ball 30, 40 yards, even feet short of the hole. And, you know, if you kind of flare one up in the air and hit a sky ball, well, you've now earned yourself a 60-footer, you know, through the chasm. And that's not what any of us want, certainly not what I want. And so that's where I think the Biarritz is worth something, because you've got to see a shot and execute it. I think the only real redeeming factor of a Biarritz here is that front pin. You know, whether you've got green before the chasm or whether you've got fairway cut before the chasm, I think that is the only real opportunity where you get the chance to hit a big boy shot and say, man, I think with the conditions, I got a little bit of wind behind. We've seen enough holes. I think there's enough thump in this turf where I'm going to try and land it on that downslope and see if it'll run up. And if you don't pull it off, you're going to be, you know, putting up the chasm or trying to hit some nifty little chip up there. I know for me, I'd be rolling a putter from just about wherever I was. Other than that, I think the Biarritz is a wonderfully planned out hole. I think it's the hole with good intentions. But it's a hole where I normally walk off the green saying, I get it, but it didn't quite work. And so for that reason, the Biarritz is going to be slightly on the overrated side for me. And I will toss it to Senor Shimp to give you his overrated.
Yeah, two quick follow-ups there. One important, one unimportant. Starting with the unimportant. I think Biarritz is one of the ultimate, and this will come into more of my holes today and what we talk about a lot. Like the conditions in a multitude of ways have to match up for the Biarritz to work right. Which I think is why in America you don't see as many Biarritz holes that work. Like if you went up and down courses in the UK and played a bunch of Biarritz holes, I think you would have a much higher rating of them relative to America, because the conditions are more universally going to be firm such that you can run it from the front all the way to that back pin. The other thing, especially in America, when it's typically not as firm, you really do kind of want a Biarritz, especially a long one, which it typically is, to be downwind, to where when you've got 265 to that back pin, like it should be a 215 shot, right? Like you should be flying at 30, 40 yards short, a little bit downwind, where Biarritz all of a sudden is like zero fun. Is if it's 240 to that back pin, it's into the wind and it's not very firm, you're like, oh, so I have to like flex a three wood back there with a high cut and try to stop it. Like that's just not what the hole's intended for. So that's thing one. Thing two, more importantly here, seeing as it is our only French template, I think the only way we could truly save the Biarritz is if there was like a little Frenchman in his French hat standing on the tee of each Biarritz in the world, serving you a choice of either a croissant or a baguette. And if that is the case, what are you taking? Are you a croissant guy, or are you taking the baguette?
Oh, fuck.
A little hunk of baguette. Maybe not the whole schlonger, but you know, like 4 to 6 inches of a baguette.
It's actually quite a tough one. I'd probably go croissant, but by a hair, you know, like I fucking love a good baguette. Depends on how hungry I am, frankly. Like if it's the third hole, I'm going croissant. If it's 16, une baguette, 100%.
I think the croissant is higher floor, lower ceiling. Like a good baguette is just so good. But I think your not as good baguette is not going to be as good as your bad croissant.
I will say this, if they're offering like baguette with a little bit of French beurre and some ham or something like that, I mean, I'm in. Like I'm all in.
Yeah, the Frenchie. Okay, no more French talk. That was way too much of that bullshit for today. Moving on to a real template hole here. Straight out of Scotland. So to me, the Redan is A, overrated, and B, the reason for which it is overrated, I think that the Redan is a bit of a victim of its own success. So the reason that I think a Redan has become so popular is it's just like, it's such an easy template to understand. It's a really cool template. When it's done right, it's absolutely awesome. The conditions, as we talked about with the Biarritz, of like, it really needs to line up. The Redan has a lot of shades of that. Like if it's not firm enough, if it's not fast enough and it doesn't quite work, then you're kind of just like, all right, I don't really get the point here. Now, when it does work, I mean, I've hit a few shots on Redans when things are right, and you're like, that is absolutely awesome. One of my favorite shots I've ever hit, the fourth Jackass Button, fourth at National Golf Links, 209 to, you know, just tucked back left pin, massive kicker on that hole. Yeah. I think it was 165 to just to cover the big false front, 9 iron just over it. I mean, it stopped 3 inches short of the hole. Would have been, you know, absolutely awesome. But think about that. You know, 210 back there, downwind, 9 iron that almost runs 45 yards down the way and nearly went in the hole. Like, it can be really, really cool when it works. But my thing with a Redan is, A, it doesn't work that much. B, talking about it being a victim of its own success, everybody who's interested in templates and wants to do one or two on their golf course thinks Redan first, seemingly. And C, it becomes man-made all too often. Like I'm all for, you know, the naturalists, the Tom Doakes and Corin Crenshaws and those who like to go out, and if someone says, hey, I'd like a Redan, they're like, okay, well, we'll see if you can find you one. And if we can, we'll do it. But if it's not already within the land, we're not doing it. Those who are like, no, flat land, like build it up, build me a Redan, I'm just not as here for that. Now, I'm being slightly hypocritical there, because there's some Redans that I absolutely love that do come on dead flat land. I'm sure there are certain people that don't like it, but the 11th at Country Club of Charleston, I think, is an awesome hole. It's one of my favorite holes anywhere. It's not an easy hole, but, you know, board flat land there, and you built a 18 or 20 foot high kicker from left to right. So I think that a man-made Redan can be really interesting, but there have just become so many of them, and many of them not being the greatest. I'm a little tired of seeing so many Redans. It's just become a watered down template to me. So I almost want to spin the term overrated and just say the Redan it's firmly and fully on overplay watch. In fact, it's way beyond overplay watch. It's been on it for years, and it's the song that we really don't need to be listening to for a long time. You know, it's like we're in our mid-20s and we've heard Mr. Brightside like 198 times over the last 7 years of our lives. And if someone plays it at their wedding when we're like 33, it's going to slap. But like, I don't need to hear Mr. Brightside until like the day I get married 8 years from now or whenever that happens to be, right? That to me is the Redan. Like if I didn't play a Redan for a few years and then I went back and played a good one, I'd be like, yeah, baby, this is awesome stuff. But it's too much. It's too much. Well, so that's the Redan.
I do feel as 15th, if...
That's the original for context.
Yeah, I do feel as if we could see some more variety in how Redans are presented. Same thing with Beerits. Like a lot of these template holes take on kind of the same look, whereas, you know, you've got a high right side or a high left side in the case of a reverse Redan. And then you've got that, you know, stereotypical front bunker and false front. And then, you know, back bunker not is kind of up to you, but, you know, the same slopes. There's only really one slope needed, and I would love to see more interpretations of Redans or Beerits that just kind of take advantage of that one singular slope, but don't make an effort to try and make the rest of it look like the stereotypical Redans or a Beerits. And that's probably unfair to say, because I'm sure that there are quite a few out there that have already done this, but as far as restorations go, I think this is typically what we see is a lot more like straight lines and things of that nature, which I'm on record. Like I love CB McDonald and Seth Rayner, and I love that kind of engineered look, but
Solo
there does.
Hibachi Nights.
And Solo Hibachi Nights. God, yeah, that was a blast from the past. You know, but it doesn't fit everywhere. So I'll just leave it at that. And then we're going to take
a final comment here. Can I make one more on these two?
Yeah, please do.
I'm all for you here on the like interpretations of templates. That's what I want to see more of, is like, okay, here is the inspiration, but it doesn't have to be like straight within the box that it came from. So mm-hmm. I think a cool Redan, now I'm going to kind of go back around to myself here, but like the downhill left to right Redan, seventh hole at Sleepy Hollow, I think is a really cool interpretation. Problem is that in Westchester County, it's only so often that you're going to get the conditions such that you actually need to use the kicker. I played Sleepy five, six times this year, and not a single one was I actually trying to like use the kicker. It was like 212 hole straight downhill. I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to rip a seven at the flag because it's soft and just let it land soft and do that, right? And so that's the whole problem with Redans in America. But I do like the sentiment there. Beerits, I've never seen a Beerits that's not dead flat. Like, what if we did a downhill Beerits? You know, what if you had a downhill hole and you're like, okay, maybe we don't have the conditions all the time for it to be dead firm, but like if it's downhill and runs away a little bit and you still have the big chasm, like it would be really cool. So how about more like interpretations of templates? I mean, this is realistically, this is a big varietals chat. Like these templates are, templates are the vehicles. And we're talking about specific varietals here. But, you know, varietals, that's what's great about them. It's like we can get creative in how we use the varietals. I mean, you've got baked purple sweet potatoes. You've got cubed purple sweet potatoes. You get it. I'm so sorry. Okay. Underrated.
My underrated this week is going to be Leaven. And I fucking love this hole for a multitude of reasons. But here we go. Little history nugget here before we really get going, really get the engines firing. The first Leaven hole, not to get everybody too hyped up about distance, but it was 311 yards, which is a pretty much a college golf par three at this point. And what I love so much about the Leaven hole is that it really has two main challenges for you on opposite sides of the hole. And it is perhaps the best, other than the punch bowl, which we'll get into later. It is the most approachable template that both tests the great player and the not so great player alike. And that's why it fires me up, because it really, you can place a leave-in on just about any hole. And in fact, we could make the argument that leave-in, like, maybe the most used template of all time, even holes that may not even know that they're interpreting the leave-in of all time. So, hey, imagine a hole that requires some sort of massive carry out of you. Par four, plenty of width, that has this string of hazard up one side of the hole. And it's very clear to anybody off the tee, like, oh man, that's going to take a monster to carry that sort of hazard. Not sure if I want to go do that. And look at all this beautiful safety off to the other side. Like, wow, that looks so appealing to me. That is course strategy 101, right? I acknowledge the trouble, I acknowledge the safety, right? The more experienced player has been through this enough to say, there's probably more to this, right? There's probably something further up the hole that makes this heroic carry worth the effort, worth the risk. And so let's say you do that exercise and you go up to the green. Well, let's take, what is it? The third at Country Club of Charleston. One of my favorite leave-ins. It's like just
fourth.
The fourth. One, two. Isn't it the third? Par four?
It's the fourth. Third's the par three.
Third's the par three. Okay. The fourth at Country Club of Charleston. It's like a benign leave-in, but it's so classy in the way that it's done. Yes. And there's this knob on the right side of, not the green, just green side right, that really, like, it's such a minimal hazard. It's not a massive hill. It's not hiding the flagstick from you, but it influences the green complex, and it really obscures your ability to, like, attack it, basically. So let's say off the tee, I choose safety. I hit to the big berth, the 30, 40 yards of open fairway, and I go
to the right with the mound, of course, being on the front right of the green.
Right. And so I'm approaching this green looking at nothing but a knob of rough. And this, albeit small, false front is now angled away from me. So if I want to hit green, I have to cover a hill that is obscuring the view of actually how big that green is. All I see is flagstick. And now you have to trust a number. You have to trust that if you hit your number, you're going to find green. And you have no certainty to work off from. Whereas if you take the line off the left, you make the carry, you now have the whole green sitting in front of you. And the slopes that are hurting you from safety are now helping you chase one back to that back pin. It's genius. Let's say you're unable to hit the ball further than 220 yards, and on a hole like this that's maybe barely over 400, you're still going to be coming into this hole with a wood. Perfectly fine. You choose safety. That's just the right play regardless. And you still have part of the green to chase your ball up onto. I think this is why the hole is so great, is it doesn't really put anybody out of the hole, but it still asks that you respect the design. So let's say you're 180 yards out. This is kind of a three wood for you. And you're smart enough to know that this hole is testing you in some sort of way. Well, man, short front of that green is a really nice leave to really any sort of pin on that green. But if you try to get aggressive and roll one up through that false front, you find yourself in the left bunker. Things are getting really tough for you very quickly. And it's just a hole that has so much variety with, like, almost no input, like a little hazard up the left. It could be a creek. It could be a bunker. It could be a hazard line. It could be out of bounds. Any of that can influence your decision. And it's just such a genius way to test somebody with, like, no dirt, basically. So big fan of the leave-in. It is, I think right now, my favorite template. And, yeah.
That was a highly, highly comprehensive leave-in breakdown, and I really don't have much to add. I too love the leave-in. You know, talking about Sleepy Hollow, there are some really cool templates out there. First hole, it's one of those. It's a leave-in, and it's one where I think the untrained eye would be like, okay, this is just like a get you out there simple hole, but it is a genius, an absolutely genius leave-in, because you look at it, and so you've got the big leave-in mound front right of the green. There's also a big bunker that's in the front right of that, so you really don't want to mess with that either. And then there's a bunker out there at probably 270 on the left side of the fairway. There's some OB left of that. It's pretty far left. It's really, you have to hit a pretty darn bad shot to bring that into play. But basically the question you're being asked is, okay, do you want to try to hug this bunker and keep it in the fairway and not have to contend with the leave-in mound, or, and probably lay back off the tee if that's the case, or do you want to take driver, still have to hug the bunker because the fairway is rather tight, and either keep it tight to the bunker in the fairway to avoid the leave-in, or then your option is you can blow it right all day long. You have 100 yards over there, but it's deep ass rough. And so I think it's just an awesome leave-in because you can bail out and hit driver way right, but then you have to A, contend with the mound, and B, you're going to be in the deep rough. So if you want to avoid the mound and play from the fairway, it actually takes contending with the bunker and hitting a really good tee ball. So that, yeah, like that's why the leave-in to me is so good, is because it's just like such simple strategy that if you don't really understand the hole, you're kind of like, why, what's the deal here? Like, I'm just going to see ball, hit ball, but you should not be doing see ball, hit ball when it comes to the leave-in. So good call there. Really good template. Moving on to my underrated template. I think this is also a rather underutilized template in certain ways, but what I like about it is it juxtaposes the Redan in that the cape hole, you can't just build a cape out of nothing. Now there are a few capes that are pretty far-fetched, I would say, extrapolations of the cape. You know, the 14th at Chicago Golf is probably not your most traditional cape ever. Now the green is certainly that of a cape. They built bunkers to essentially serve as your hazard of choice. Your traditional cape is going to have either a pond, think, you know, the 13th at National Golf Links, jackass button once again. That's like a little tidal area. It could be the ocean. It could be a big sort of badlands area, just something that you don't want any part of. And essentially the hole, imagine like a large circle, the hole bends all the way around that to where you're teeing off at 6 o'clock and you're going clockwise to 12 o'clock. It can also go the other way. You could be at 6 o'clock and go counterclockwise to 12 o'clock. But the idea is that the hole bends itself around a large hazard on the interior of the hole. And then it's not, you know, typically not a tiny green, but not your largest green that's heavily protected by either bunkers or what I really want to see. And I don't recall playing one, but I fantasize about the idea of this is like sicko sort of stuff, because obviously I can't ship off short grass, but imagine an awesome cape where rather than bunkers, it was just like a slightly popped up green and it's just short grass as your penalty. Like that would be a really cool version of a cape.
Huh. Yeah.
So anyway, a great cape. The question it's asking you, and similar, you know, I'll throw in a similar comment here to the leave-in, that the cape does not discriminate against any golfer. If it's a 320-yard cape, which commonly they are rather short holes, if you hit your driver 220, you just play it straight away. You know, let's pretend it's a left-to-right cape. You just hit it straight away and hit an iron in. That just is what it is. But the great capes, what they make really interesting is I do find that oftentimes they're into the wind, but you know, it's not overly important. The question that you're asked is, do you want to hit it 300 yards at the pin and take on all the trouble and the bunkers up near the green and of course your hazard or bad area to the right, or do you want to hit it 300 yards, 80 or 100 yards left of the hole and play from there? So oftentimes, like, the actual shot you're hitting actually doesn't differ that much. It's not a short par four most of the time, such that it's driver towards the green or four irons to lay back. It's actually driver's kind of the play. It's just, do you want to take on the hazard or do you want to play safe out to the left or right? And so that's what I think is really interesting about it, is that it is the ultimate decision-making sort of template where, depending on the wind direction, depending on where the hole location is, the question that's asked of you is just simply, how aggressive do we want to get here? How much do you want to try to bite off? And that to me is what makes a cape really fun. I think that probably one of the best capes that I've played is certainly the seventh at Cal Club. And so many times I've hit two irons and three woods, like greenside, just right at the pin and let it happen. I've hit so many full drivers and had nine irons in. And that, like, that's what I think makes the hole so, so awesome is when, depending on the wind direction, depending on how cold it is, all of the, depending on how you're playing, all of these different factors, you're hitting the same shot. It's just like, how good do you feel today? You know, how confident are you that you're not going to hit a freaking tinder ball out into the shit and lose your ball and then be re-teeing. So a good cape. The final thing I'll say is that it is where I started that yes, you can with bunkers and things, you can kind of create a cape, which I think is a fun way. Like I am all for, as I mentioned before, kind of the inspired template holes. Like, okay, this is the inspiration, but then let's put our spin on it. But by and large with a cape, it has to be there. You know, you do have to show up and say like, okay, well, I can put a tee here and a green there. And like, that's my cape because here's this hazard or bad area that, you know, you're not going to want to contend with. It's really hard to just say like, oh yeah, like I want a cape on this golf course. Like fine, you know, build me a cape. It's pretty antithetical to how
that's gonna, cape. That's going to be expensive.
Yeah. Just build me a lake. You know, I'm sure. I mean, if it's been done. Had any respect for Los Templates, there would be a cape that he had built that was just a lake moving, you know, 50,000 pounds of dirt, tons of dirt rather. Yeah, good stuff.
You know what I'd love to see, picture this for a minute, is a cape in terms of its shape, but kind of an Alps interpretation where the inside, imagine like 17 at Sawgrass, but...
Oh, dude, I'm so in on this. I was thinking about this earlier.
But flexible, right? So the hole moves left slightly and you see the green, but everything past the hazard line falls away from you, right?
Right.
So there's like this mound in between the heroic line right at the green, and then kind of right just to the right of the heroic line, which would be the ideal kind of layup, is this giant mound. Everything falls away. That is a recipe for a great hole. But as you said, you can't build it. You have to kind of, it has to just be kind of sitting there. But that's the type of hole that you build 17 other holes around. You know, I've never seen anything like that.
Hey, one, this is like, I'm kind of going backwards here slightly to the leave-in, but it's like, it's a bit of a cape, bit of a leave-in, definitely much more so a leave-in, but it has cape sort of qualities to it. One of my favorite golf holes in the world is the fourth at Pacific Dunes. It's such a brilliant, I don't know if you know Pacific Dunes at all, but absolutely brilliant hole. So think about it. It runs left to right along the coast. It's a slight dogleg to the right. And so basically what's being done here is there's a big bunker and what basically serves as a leave-in mound on the front left part of the green. So it's like, hey, look, man, you've got the world to the left of you. You can hit it left all day, but there are bunkers. And then if you're going to have to contend with this like very large mound in the front left of the green, or if you want to have a good view, you got to take on the old Pacific Ocean. Which one do you want to do? And so it's just like, it is the ultimate when you talk about the extravagance of the hazards and the penalties, it's just so damn good. I mean, imagine building a really cool leave-in hole or what serves as one along the coast when you have like a 100-foot coast in front of you. Just absolutely awesome. Just kind of came to me. But
I'm looking final at comment now. There. That's a really good looking hole.
Tommy D knows he knows his stuff.
Hey, let's go move on. In person.
I'd love to. Let's move on to properly rated before we do that.
All right. Properly rated. I feel like I had to do it to you guys. We're going to go punch bowl today. Everybody loves a punch bowl, and we're here to talk about why.
Punch bowl pack DC here.
Had to be done. Shout out to DC. One of my favorite guys. You know, the punch bowl is all about the anticipation. Like, to a certain degree, it's kind of why we play golf. You know, growing up, one of the most commonly used terms is like, yeah, it's all out there in front of you, you know, and that's not the punch bowl. And that's what I love about it. Like, why is golf even worth playing if you can't lose the vision of your golf ball a little bit and use your imagination and be presented with some sort of question or challenge where you're like, okay,
I know my carry numbers to a certain degree. Like if you're a great player, you know them to the half yard. And if you suck, you got a 20 yard bandwidth to choose from. Like, ah, I may hit this within this and this, regardless of what you have, the punch bowl, whether it's just down deep in a chasm and you've got to just guess, or whether you have a pretty good understanding of what lies behind that kind of hill. The punch bowl requires you to kind of let go of all your analyzation and prediction, and it makes you choose kind of the shot that you want to hit. And for the entirety of, you know, after you've made contact with the ball, walking up to the green, you're like, yeah, fuck it, I don't know. I think it's pretty good. Maybe an inch from the hole. It may be disappointingly 40 feet from the hole, but that just kind of that's left up to golf course. That's left up to fate. And that is why the punch bowl is so interesting. And as you see more punch bowls, you start to understand that, like, okay, this isn't this has like the most range of
many
of
layers to the punch bowl.
Many layers. There are kind of these punch bowls that truly were made to be punch bowls. Like they're sitting down in this proper valley, and you can clearly see where the water exits, and it was a made to be punch bowl. And then you've got these punch bowls that are almost built into a hill, where like you have to hit up into them, and there are different sections of the punch bowl. Like we were in Nolens a couple weeks ago and saw Metairie Country Club, which had basically every template that we've talked about so far today. And that punch bowl was so cool because you weren't really hitting down into this thing. The 40 or 50 yards before the green had a pretty serious rise to it, which made the punch bowl what it is. I mean, in reality, the green surface was about level with the majority of the fairway. It was just disguised to be some sort of punch bowl. And, you know, you had that section in the upper right, which was quite seriously a shelf. Like, that is a different thing than hitting it into the lower left quadrant, which is like the bottom of the barrel. You know, that's where you put a pin down there and you can really, really get one close. But the punch bowl to me is just like a necessary supplement with golf. Like, we love Pinehurst. I love greens that are turned over bowls and really ask you from 100 yards to absolute, like, throw your ball on a blanket, on a 5x5 blanket with the right trajectory and the right spin. Like, those are necessary questions that a golf course needs to ask you. But equally, I love having a long iron, which these days is like refreshing into a par 4 or a par 5, knowing that, hey man, as long as I keep this thing under the wind and I let it chase, it's up to today what happens with this ball. And that there's something about that makes golf so worth playing. And for that reason, combined with the fact that I think people will have and forever will love punch bowls, I think this is the most properly rated, recession proof, here to stay template in the game, the punch bowl. So there we are. Chimpy, what you got for your properly rated?
Yeah, I've got stuff to add on the punch bowl, but I'm not going to. That was good color, and I think it is about properly rated. You've got great ones, you've got ones that look good but probably don't play that good, everything in between. So properly rated L punch bowl. I'm going to wrap us up here with a template you mentioned recently. The Alps hole, I think, is a rather properly rated template, all things being considered. So I kind of started with the Redan, a hole that's just firmly on overplay watch. Everyone's got a Redan. Oftentimes, it's just completely man-made. I then went to the Cape. I don't think there are quite enough Capes out there. And a Cape is really hard to create. I think the Alps sits like very much in between those two. Yes, you're going to see people kind of build an Alps and say, hey, like, let's build a mound here in front of the green. So an Alps is, you know, it's similar in certain ways to a leave-in, but a leave-in is meant to provide angles to you. It's supposed to say, okay, this is on one side of the hole. And so depending on where you want to try to play your tee ball, that's the decision that you're making is, do I want to try to avoid this leave-in and have a better look and a better angle, or do I want to hit the easier tee ball and then take it on? The
it's Alps more about is first meant, shot.
Right. The Alps is meant to obscure your view on the second shot. Dare I say, irregardless, the most superfluous word in the alphabet, or in the dictionary, rather. I don't know why we need irregardless. Technically is in the dictionary. It's right, but like it means the same thing as regardless. You don't need to add the two letters for anybody wondering. So irregardless, dare I say, of where you hit your tee ball, the idea is that you're going to have a somewhat obscured second shot, not always from the pin in full, but from the level of the green. You typically can't necessarily see where your ball is going to end up or what you're hitting at. And it's one of those things you're kind of like, oh, well, if I can see the top of the flag, like, great, you know. But I think there's some very low-key Alps where, yeah, you can see the top of the pin, but you can't see the green, and it does, like, it makes it harder. It undoubtedly makes the shot a little bit more confusing, a little bit harder. You also have Alps holes like, once again, Jackass Button, the third at National Golf Links. Not surprisingly, I've mentioned National Golf Links three times here today because we are talking about template holes, the template mecca of America, where it's like, it's almost a half Alps, half punch bowl in my mind, where like you have to hit over this massive mound and you have no idea where you're hitting it to. You know that the ball does sort of funnel in different directions, but you know, that's kind of like a mega Alps, and certainly one where I say that some Alps holes, you could say, hey, like, let's do an Alps here. Let's build something up in front of the green so that your view is obscured a bit. And then you have holes like National Golf Links, and I could be wrong, but I'm guessing they did not build that Alps mound there. It's much too large to have done that. I think the Alps is one that people just don't understand fully. The difficulty of an Alps is very subtle. I always appreciate subtle difficulty. The original Alps, of course, 17, if I'm not mistaken, at Prestwick. And just a simple Alps, it's not a mega National Golf Links-esque Alps where you can't see a thing coming in. It's more of like, hey, you can probably get your hands around where the flag is. But from there, your view of where the ball actually ends up is going to be obscured. And it's just kind of like, hey, you've got your number, you know what your line is, and now can you hit a shot? I think that's probably that captures to me why the Alps is about properly rated. Most people, I think, most people really don't like blind shots. And I totally get that. When you can't tell where you're hitting, that's one thing. But I think that there's a very clear difference between not being able to tell where you're hitting and where your ball is landing necessarily. The Alps, most of the time, you know where you're hitting. You know where the pin is. You know what your line is. You just can't quite see that ball land. I think that's a great thing in golf because it's a little bit more of that, like, here it is, like, can you do it, right? Whereas if you get up to a tee box and you're hitting over a big hill and someone just says to you, hey, like, you know, try to hit that bush out there, but, you know, you'll see it when you get down there, you know? I think that's where people are kind of like, I would like to have a sense of where I'm going here. The Alps, like, sits kind of right in the middle of that whole conversation. And a good Alps, let's even say a great Alps is very unlike to be the best hole on any templated golf course, but it can be a really strong one. And so that's why I think the Alps is a properly rated template. I could see a few more Alps out there, but I'm pretty pleased overall with where things sit in the world of the Alps hole.
I feel like the Alps is almost certainly the song in the album there where you listen to it the first couple times and go, I like that song better. And then fourth or fifth listen to the album, you go, yeah,
I like the Alps. And it's like the sixth or seventh song on a 10 or 11 song album.
Yes.
You know, it's like, it's not going to be one of the first three out because the artist knows, like, this isn't my banger. You know, like, I need to kind of sit this in there, but it kind of keeps you going, right? Like, those sixth and seventh songs are important because it's like, well, did I get through four songs and now like I have to really fight to get to nine, or is there some solid stuff in there? It's like in baseball, like that fifth batter, sixth batter, it matters. Like, we know that the eighth and ninth guys, they don't have much juice. Even the seventh man in the lineup, like, probably doesn't have much of a bat, but like, look, first guy gets out, second guy gets walked, third guy strikes out, fourth guy gets on base. That fifth hitter matters. Like, you got two guys on base. We need some action. That's the Alps. He keeps you going. in the mid to late part of the lineup. He's not going to be your absolute horse, but he's not a pony either. Great name, too. One of the top names.
That's the Alps. This is Mudball Monday. You're listening to the Tide Podcast. Thanks for being here, and we'll see you later on this week. Peace.
Cheers.